This is Trust Me, I'm Certified, brought to you by GX Certifications, a podcast exploring how to conquer imposter syndrome. Welcome back to Trust Me, I'm Certified. I'm Jason Nicola, and our guest this episode is Jessica Hyde. She's now one of the leading experts in digital forensics as a director at Magnet Forensics and adjunct professor at George Mason University. She's hard to miss in the DFOR world as a frequent speaker, SANS DFOR Summit advisory board member, among many, many other contributions to the DFOR community. How she ended up here, though, is just such an interesting and inspiring story. Probably one of my favorites that we've learned about here on the show. And what I love about it is that Jessica has been on a mission for the better part of two decades, one that has not only seen her transform herself and the notion of the power she has in the world, but also has seen her become very outward-facing in continually leveraging her skills to battle for the greater good. This was a really compelling conversation, and I feel like Jessica is basically one of my heroes now. There's so much great stuff here, and I hope you all leave the conversation with a jolt of inspiration to go out in the world and find your own sense of mission and purpose and infuse that in your career where you can. So here it is. Enjoy. All right, Jessica Hyde, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Jason.
So your exposure to engineering came in the Marine Corps, right?
Yes and no. So before the Marine Corps, I had really no idea what I wanted to do. And Marine Corps took the ASVAB and they said, hey, engineering is good. And so I started doing electronic analysis of aircraft. It became an avionics man, much similar to Leslie Carhart. I actually think it's funny that the two digital forensics examiners that you've had on the show both happened to be aviation electricians in the military before going into DFIR, yeah. Which is really interesting. And another forensicator, I know Eric Capano, who's a SANS instructor, also happens to have taken this bizarre path of working in avionics and then winding up in digital forensics, which are askew fields.
Maybe we found something here.
Maybe we found something. Maybe we need to recruit incident responders from avionics out of the military.
Right.
But yeah, so that made me realize that I actually liked circuitry and electronics and some exposure to DCAC theory. And so, yeah, and then I started trying to go to school while being on active duty and get an electronics engineering degree.
Yeah.
So that was, and then I think I started doing real engineering after that, as I started doing reverse engineering in a lab, whereas reverse engineering IEDs. So that's when I actually started doing engineering as opposed to just troubleshooting and analysis.
So before that, were you into technology as a kid? Did you build things, break things? What were you doing?
Yeah, as a kid. So, I mean, when I was young, I was very lucky that I had an uncle who had a Commodore 64. Mm. And he used to babysit me. It was my only exposure to electronics. I didn't grow up with much means. And he brought over the C64 and plugged it into our TV set. And at about 4, I wrote my first program, which was really, really simple. It was to take phone numbers and show all the alphanumeric constructs that they could be with those 7 numbers. And I can tell you, my first phone number was SHEPEST, S-H-E-P-E-S-T, 743-7378. And I know that because of that. And so I was became obsessed with patterns and how things can be encoded and decoded.
Yeah.
And so that was my first exposure. But to be honest, I didn't have technology in the home.
Right.
And I had some exposure at school, but not really great until I got to high school and was able to take programming classes and robotics classes.
Yeah.
But then I really left that all behind. When I graduated, I'll be clear first, I actually am a high school dropout. Mm-hmm. Who now teaches grad school and has a graduate degree. But that shows it doesn't matter where you came from. But I went into retail management until September 11th. So I really was not touching technology outside of operating a point of sale system, which is weird then when you investigate them. But I was a retail manager for years before September 11th. And then I went in the Marine Corps, and the Marine Corps was like, hey, you're good with this stuff because of the ASVAB, you're good at electronics, and we're going to send you to avionics school. So it was almost like it reignited something I forgot I lost. I didn't remember how much I loved solving problems, decoding things, troubleshooting, trying to understand things and how they work. And it really reignited that passion that I had had as a young child, but that was stifled because it wasn't as common in society. It wasn't as prevalent. I will say I did some phone freaking, but that was more because I had a boyfriend in another state and I wanted to make long distance calls. So I did. I was a minor, and there may have been some things. I figured out the algorithm for calling cards, but that's okay because I had a reason to. But that was my youth, and that was all very reformed. Different. Reformed, much so. Yeah. Use your powers for good. Right. I thought it was good. I thought I was making good long distance calls to my boyfriend, but from cell phones. And by the way, I learned also how you get caught, because if I happen to have been generating calling cards, I can't believe I'm talking about this, calling card numbers that actually worked. And using them, I always use them from payphones to call payphones. And then one day I was stupid and I called my boyfriend at that time at his house instead of at a payphone. And the phone company took note and was able to figure it out. And he gave me up. So,
so is that the end of the relationship?
Yeah, you can say that.
It was time.
don't dime somebody out for, right. Yes. But I used to have a little, tone emulator and the whole paperclip trick and all of that stuff back in the day. I'm definitely dating myself by the fact that so the irony is that, what I've primarily worked in is mobile forensics.
Right.
So definitely some irony in both my first coding project, and I actually have never really related this myself,
right,
being translating phone numbers into words, very apropos, I guess, to what I wound up doing later in life that I never expected I would do.
Right.
And then getting in trouble for doing a little bit of phone freaking and calling card generation back when that was a thing, to now reversing Android apps, right?
Right.
That's a completely... I never put it together. So thank you, Jason, for bringing that up.
Well, there was so much there that we should dig into, but where you went with it was exactly where I was going to go. It's like, it's so interesting to me how in the moment and looking ahead, it doesn't seem like there's any connection between these things. And you don't see like, hey, I'm a 4-year-old that is encoding and decoding my phone number on a Commodore 64. Like, in a really good way, but that's kind of weird. I don't think that's common, right? So, I'm sure there are some tellings of your background where it's like, yeah, I joined the Marine Corps and, I was exposed to engineering and I got out and started doing some reversing. But really, there's a lot more to it than that, especially as you start to connect in the phone freaking. And it's really cool to look back and identify the things that you didn't know were there and then kind of piece them together and go, maybe this was going to happen. Maybe I ended up doing what I was supposed to be doing,
Right. And, I never thought of those things as being part of my story of how I got here. So thank you for eliciting that out of me. I had no idea it existed.
Well, thanks for telling it. Yeah.
Kind of neat connections to find. So I kind of encourage anyone who's listening to this to think back now to the things you did as a kid and how do they relate, even if you don't think they did.
It's right. Yeah. Like I was prepared to ask some really general questions about like, hey, did you like doing puzzles and did you, like figuring stuff out? And it's like, yeah, I was, encoding and decoding my phone number and phone freaking. And it's like, okay, yeah, this all makes perfect sense.
It does. And if you think about it, that's all about figuring out how things work. And then how do I use that in a technological means?
For sure. Yeah.
Only now using powers for good.
Right. Definitely. So another thing you mentioned is working in retail, well, dropping out of high school, working in retail, and then September 11th happened. And I don't want to, I'm assuming that was what, spurred you into the military.
100%. Yeah. I was on Paris Island October 28th, 2001.
Okay, right. Why was that important to you to do?
I mean, for the obvious reason. So I mean, my dad worked right there, and he was missing at the time I enlisted. My dad thankfully was okay. He just kind of shut down after seeing what he saw. But I knew people. We all lost people. I lived in New Jersey. I saw the towers fall with my own two eyes. I was working retail at the time. I was a store manager of the Abercrombie & Finch in the Livingston Mall, New Jersey. Okay. After the second plane hit, we basically closed everything in New Jersey that was a possible target, and being a mall, was immediately closed. Mm-hmm. And I drove home, and at the time, I lived in a town called Hawthorne, and my apartment happened to be, like, my neighborhood was on a hill. And because of that, from my living room window, you could see the towers. I saw them fall with my own two eyes. And I realized at that moment, and I'm sure you can hear this in my voice, but that I had to do something more important with my life, that it wasn't about just getting by and seeing my friends and doing the things I enjoyed at that point, that I needed to use my skills and my brain and my body and my all to do something that mattered. And I spoke to a recruiter, got an education waiver because I scored high enough on the ASVAB or the pre-ASVAB. But first you take a pretest, and they wouldn't have even spoken to me. I scored enough on the ASVAB for them to let me in with a GED, I believe, in 2001, don't quote me on this, that my recruiter told me, so who knows how true it is, that there were only three education waivers that year, and I was one of three. It did help that I was a female. There are quotas to get enough females to run the actual platoons at boot camp. Went into the Marine Corps, and it's the smartest, best decision I made. A lot of people felt it was a bad reaction to grief. On September 10th, one of my roommates died of a heart attack, completely unassociated. The events of September 11th, and I had lost an infant brother that year at 5 days. My friends had betting pools that I would not make it through boot camp. Wow. And I was the kind of person who always did something that was unexpected. And the most unexpected thing I could do was to complete it and do it. And so I did. And it's all mind over matter, right? I mean, so at the time I was 4'11". I was probably 100 pounds soaking wet. I was not normally what people think of when they think of a Marine.
Sure.
But being a Marine, it's not your physique. That all can be built. It's your mind. Mm-hmm. And the thing we used to say is mind over matter. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter.
Right.
And that's like something I live with every day, and it made me who I am. If it wasn't for the Marine Corps, I would have not gone to college. I wouldn't have earned a degree in electronics engineering and a master's in computer forensics. The Marine Corps basically paid for that. I used my GI Bill, and I went to school while on active duty. I wouldn't have met my spouse, who happens to be a pen tester now, but we were both avionics men together in the Marine Corps. So maybe this, again, goes to this point of being right. in avionics and then winding up in InfoSec. I wouldn't have had my children. I wouldn't have been exposed to the things I was exposed to. I wouldn't have most of the relationships I have. I wouldn't have had the opportunity to learn that I love electronics and to be reinstigated with that. The Marine Corps gave me everything. Mm-hmm. The Jessica you talked to today wasn't born in Orange, New Jersey. The Jessica you speak to today was born in Parris Island, South Carolina.
That's powerful. That's succinct. It's important. Yeah.
Yeah. So the worst day of my life gave me the greatest thing in my life. And if anything beats a terrorist, it's that. And I mean, I'm fortunate enough that when I left the Marine Corps, I continued that mission in reverse engineering IEDs and then going and working in counterterrorism labs doing forensics. And now I build tools to help other people do that. And at the end of the day, what I get is I get that sense of mission, and I know I'm doing something with my life.
You took the words right out of my mouth, because the the thing that I find among, you know, people who are, well, many people who are successful, companies that do really well, and just people you want to be around and respect, it's they have some kind of a sense of mission. It's not just I'm going to go do this because the money's great, or you know, because this is the next thing that's up. It's about, no, I want to help move people out of poverty, or I want to try to translate more opportunities to people who don't have them, or I don't want to let the bad guys win, you know, think, whatever it might be. I think it's really, really important to find that mission. And it lends so much context to the real grind of what you have to do, especially in this industry and with a lot of the things that you've been doing for throughout your career. So yeah, that mission's important.
And I think it's 100% that, right? Because mission gives you drive, mission gives you passion. And I don't see how anyone working in DFIR or even in broader InfoSec cannot have that sense of knowing that what you do matters. There's a great quote from Ronald Reagan that says, some people wonder their whole life if they've made a difference. Marines don't have that problem. Hmm. And I feel like that equally applies to digital forensics, incident response, and InfoSec overall. We are fighting the digital fight. And that's the fight of today. Look at the world right now.
Sure. So post-military, did you know exactly what you wanted to do when you left the military? And what was that process like to translate to a professional career?
No, I hadn't. It's just like most people who wind up in this field, they had no idea where they wanted to be. Like, right. I wish I could say, oh, you know, I fell in love with hearing stories about forensic cases and solving them. And I decided I was going to be a forensicator, and I went to school for forensics. And I wish I had that story, because, wow, that shows just something that's innate that you know that you love.
Right.
No, I got out. I had an engineering degree. I had a clearance. I applied for some jobs. I had been I was in Northern Virginia outside the DC metro area, mainly because my husband's work had brought them there after he left the military. We got together after he left the military. He continued in avionics, got a networking degree. I got an engineering degree. And then we wound up at one point in our lives, both being directors of forensics at the same time. He's now a pen tester, but very, very weird, because completely different paths after we left the same and then came to the same. But so his job had brought him to DC. And so obviously I went there as well. So I was still on active duty. He was in DC. I was in Norfolk. We were traveling. And then we had two small children. He was doing like the 4 day a week, driving down to Norfolk for 3 days. It's like a 3 hour drive. And so that was our life. I was going to school and on active duty, the whole spiel, with two small children.
Wow.
And so eventually, when I got out, went up to Northern Virginia, had to immediately find work. I stumbled across this position that I interviewed for a couple of positions. Some were working for companies that were doing manufacturing of chips. Some were, right? So I had this electronics engineering degree. I wanted to do something in electronics. It's where I'd spent the last 6 years of my life in the Marine Corps. And I went on this interview for this contracting job for the government that did not disclose what the work was, because you don't put "we reverse engineer IEDs" on the on the job posting.
I haven't seen that on Craigslist lately.
Yeah, it was an electronics engineering position. It was in the same town where the townhouse we were renting happened to be. And it was like 3 miles from my house. So I applied to it. I went into the interview, and I remember feeling like I was taking an oral final for my digital fundamentals course in college. And it was horrid. And then they had me write a description of a stapler. They're like, give the physical and do this whole description, because they want to test my writing, which, by the way, is like the most important thing that a forensicator needs to know how to do. It's sure. How to write a report. And right. I'm guessing, well, actually, I know. I worked there for 3 years, and they flat out told me the reason they did that was they would hire all these good engineers and then find out they couldn't report on their findings.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't report on your findings, your work is nothing.
Right.
Right. That's the outcome. That's our product, is right. Reports for you. Right. So I had to write about the functional and physical descriptions of a stapler, one paragraph on each. And I thought it was the worst interview I ever did in my life, because it was just so, there was no, we want to know who you are, if you're a good fit for the company or whatever. And I had no idea what they did, because it was such an obscure posting.
Right.
And so then when they contacted me about the job, I'm like, yeah, what is this? And they're like, oh, well, now we can tell you what we do, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, and I got some offers and I was like, well, this definitely sounds the most interesting. And this is the thing where I can still give back to my brothers and sisters who are getting KIA and hurt in the field by trying to find out who did this,
right,
so that we can stop the next IED from going off, right? That's mm-hmm. the entire mission there. And it was freaking fantabulous. And phones are used in IEDs. And that's literally how I got into mobile forensics. But I started the exact backwards way because everything I got was post-blast, right? Hmm. So I had to figure out the schematic of how this was used as an IED and then figure out how to get data off of, and this is pre-smartphones, off right. of a phone that's BTFU.
It was literally blown up. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Blown the F up. So, and how to get data off of those, which meant everything was at the hardware level. Everything right. was extracting at the hardware level and figuring out the data storage. And I couldn't plug it into a Cellebrite. I had a Cellebrite, but that wasn't useful.
Right.
I mean, it could be once you had the data extraction and you had a full physical and you ran some parsers against it. But mm-hmm. for the most part, that wasn't where the work was started or what the intense work was, if that makes sense.
So I always like to imagine like a Rocky training montage for people working in technology. Is that where it happened for you? Was it strictly day job stuff? Because, you know, you were coming out of the military, you had gotten your degree, you have some kids at home, your husband's a busy guy, you get this job and it's interesting to you and you get to use a lot of the skills you had, but it wasn't very neatly exactly what you had been doing.
No, it wasn't.
How do you fill in the skills? Yeah,
it wasn't at all. And that's exactly it. I realized that I had skill gaps, especially when it was like, how do we get the dad off the phone? And I'm like, well, I got a little GI Bill money left. I'm going to, after work, go and work on my MS in computer forensics. So I started simultaneously while working in a lab, working on my master's in computer forensics to start filling in the gaps. Mm-hmm. And my lab originally didn't do the forensic analysis of the data off the devices. We were actually originally just strictly positioned at doing that, but that's what I thought was interesting. So I went and mm-hmm. studied it, and then I brought that back to my lab. And my lab skilled up and started doing that work and actually took that work from another lab that was supposed to be doing it originally. And now that lab still does that work. And so, you know, started looking at the hard drives, started looking at the phone, started the actual data that was recovered after we did the hard data recovery, which was more where we were focused was schematic development, data recovery, microcontroller reverse assembly. I did a lot of microcontroller code reversing, which is weird because most people, when they learn to reverse, I don't think that they're in assembly. It was all push, pop, move for me when I learned to reverse. So I actually am better, more comfortable in assembly for reversing than I am in higher languages, but that's neither here nor there. But it's just because it's where I spent years of time working, and that's what makes a difference. So to be honest, I think it's what's neat is because I think if you have a varied past, you bring different elements and different thought processes to what you do. Sure. To be honest, I still use skills that I use to repair jets when I'm doing analysis of IoT devices.
Right.
Right. I shoot wires or the board to find my grounds, to find my RXTX. And those are just such basic things to me. I'm not afraid to pull out the soldering iron, right? I've done silver solder on a ladder, you know, in high winds during, right, in a snowstorm before, in obscure situations. I've soldered and I'm upside down with a soldering iron with silver, right, solder, which has a higher melting point. So, you know, so like soldering on a board is not a big deal, right?
Right.
I used to be an IPC trainer where I could 7711, 7721, where I would teach soldering as part of my function in that lab. But no, you're right. It's the outside, right? So I went outside and I got the degree and I studied. And then I became obsessive that my free time can always be used to make me better, right? Mm. Like, how can I get better and learn more? So I was trying to fill in those gaps. So I learned those gaps and then I brought those gaps to my job. And so that's really interesting. And then in the montage that you were describing, mm-hmm, I identified another gap, which was I wasn't well-rounded. I was very specific into mobile. I was very specific into forensics. I was very heavy engineering, but now I've gotten this exposure to the broader computer forensics through the master's program at George Mason, where I later started teaching. But so I decided to leave that role to broaden myself and took an incident response job at EY, a consultancy, where then I was able to instead focus more on IR, intrusion, HR violations, and much more heavily on the computer and network side, which is where I was weak. And I needed that. I needed that exposure. Does that make sense? So like I needed to round myself that way. And that has immensely helped my career now.
For sure.
Because, you know, I worked with agencies like the ATF, who was my liaison when I was in the reverse engineering lab. And with agents and did things that were both intel and law enforcement-based cases. And then I went out and did corporate incident response and HR investigations and user investigations that were more computer and network-based. And then I went back into a mobile forensics lab in government. And so I think that the identification that I needed to broaden and widen my skills and taking that step to do it was something that I think really helped me. I think we need to put ourselves outside of our comfort zones. You were kind of saying like, how do you shape a career? And I think that that's really part of it is recognizing when you have skill deficits that you're not going to achieve in your current place. If you can achieve them in your current place, do it. Like my current role, I luckily have enough flexibility to grow and garner any way that I feel that I need to, and I can express those things and grow and garner in different ways. Right. But I didn't necessarily have that in a lab with such a specific mission. So I went someplace that had a broader and different mission and that the education and training still was necessary and then was able to grow different ways. So I highly advise getting out of your comfort zone and regardless of how you do that.
Right.
So yeah, that's kind of...
You said something that was really interesting about how even today you still reference back to and benefit from your avionics experience.
Absolutely.
Do you think that you still benefit from your retail experience? We had Ladrina Churn.
Yes.
We recorded it recently and she had a similar experience in, you know, about communication and being customer facing and distilling your message and things
so
like that. Yeah.
This is incredible. So one of the most important skills to being able to be outside of the lab, to talk to customers, to relate things. I mean, I've briefed generals of foreign countries. I've briefed dignitaries. But I also have spoken to customers at organizations. And having good customer face and that skill is actually incredible. And I absolutely learned that. I also learned a lot about leadership, believe it or not, in retail before even going to the Marine Corps. Because I was leading teams of people who had varying interests, a lot of part-timers, this wasn't their primary function. And how do you lead and motivate people who aren't doing this because they want to, who are not passionate about what they're doing?
Right.
And finding ways to lead and motivate. Like, I remember doing really silly things, like having, you know, running my own contest, not just about sales, but about interactions and, you know, putting jelly beans in jars and having people guess whose jar was who, not knowing that I was doing things off of metrics. So they didn't know which jar was theirs that was getting filled. And it was a race to the top, but they didn't know which jar they had. And then they actually got to guess which jar they had. And people learned more about themselves.
Right.
And I learned a lot about time management, about scheduling, about lots of these interesting little nuanced things that you don't necessarily go, oh, that's technically related. But most of my soft skills actually came from that experience of being in retail and being a retail manager. And this is why I advocate to teams that it is incredibly, incredibly important to have career switchers on your team. Your whole team doesn't need to be people who have done lateral moves, but having that perspective is going to help you understand. And you brought up something else here, maybe Ladrina did, and I haven't obviously seen it because it hasn't aired yet, but everybody else probably will have, is that when you learn how to relate to people of diverse backgrounds who you've never met before.
Right.
So it helps with that pitch and being able to understand, because again, you're talking to people on their worst day when you're doing forensics or you're talking to people who are investigating the worst day.
Right.
And in doing that, you need good communication skills, and you also need to make things relatable to people. You need to very quickly find ways to connect with people so that they have trust in what you're saying and they want to listen.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to take your advice for what it's worth and feel that you're advising them truly as you mm-hmm. feel, and that you're showing that honesty. And that's connection you have to make with people.
For sure. Yeah. And it's also not their fault that they're not a forensic expert.
Right? Absolutely. So, yeah. So this is, I was actually having this discussion yesterday with somebody, and I said, one of the most amazing, actually, I was talking to Matthew Mitchell, who's going to be giving the keynote at the SANS Defer Summit. He will have mm-hmm. done this by the time anyone sees the recording. And he is in a Hacking for Good world, and he's amazing. One of my favorite, I have so many favorite people, but he's definitely in my favorite people list. And he's incredible, runs Crypto Harlem, does all these amazing things for good. Mm-hmm. And we were having a discussion a little bit about what forensicators are like. And I said, you know what skill every good forensicator has? Every good forensicator can give great analogies, because right. they have to be able to dispel very technical research and very technical findings to, and I don't care if you're in academia or, and you're giving a presentation, or if you're in law enforcement or you're in incident response and advising CISOs and CEOs, mm-hmm. you need to be able to take very technical concepts and make them relatable and understandable.
Right.
And so we all have this amazing skill that's not tapped into, that is a hard skill for people to develop, but mm-hmm. you get it from going through the trenches and having to learn how to brief people.
For sure. So forensics in general, and especially a lot of the hardware stuff that you've talked about and that you've done in your career, is very intimidating for most people. It's intimidating for me. What made you think that you could do this stuff?
So to be honest, I'm the kind of person who goes, you don't know what you can do until you do it.
Right.
So just do it. Right? You don't know if you can learn a foreign language. You don't know if you can play a musical instrument. You don't know if you can dance. I joined the Marine Corps not knowing how to swim. That is a pretty bold freaking thing to do. I said, I grew up with no means. I never had access to a pool. I didn't know how to swim. We played in a fire hydrant when it was hot. Right. So when I went into the Marine Corps, I knew darn well that I was going to have to pass swim qual. But I had faith and confidence in the fact that they knew how to train me.
Mm-hmm.
And that by the end of the day, that I would figure it out. As long as I could do what I was told. I can follow instructions. I can pay attention. I can right. study hard and I can work hard. So I might mm-hmm. not get it day one out the gate, but I'm going to tell you, I am going to learn it. By the end of the day, I was jumping off the 20-foot platform in full gear and doing that swim across the pool. And I did not know how to swim. I walked in the pool. They told us to swim across and I went to the bottom. They pulled me out. They told me what to do. And I step by step learned. And right. that's how you approach anything. So if I could join the Marine Corps not knowing how to swim and pass swim qual on the first day, mm-hmm. some people passed it by the end of the week, but everyone passed.
Right.
You can do it. It is going to take you a different journey. It's going to take you a different amount of time, but you can do it. So with anything, I say, I don't know how good I'm going to be at this, but if I put enough in, I'll be able to pass. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it is, right? Like a SANS course is like drinking from a fire hydrant, even when you know the content.
Right. Yeah, it is.
And drink from that fire hydrant and then study and work at it and you'll get there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's about. So, and then I guess even the more important part is the harder part isn't, I don't think the harder part for people is trying something. I think the harder part for people is saying, I know enough to share with others what I learned.
Right.
And that's actually the more important part people need to do.
Totally agree. Yeah. It's everyone. Unfortunate because it's one of the most critical parts of the learning process is being able to, like you said yes. earlier, distill down what you know in a way that lands with other people. And that is really difficult to do if you don't know what you're talking about.
But here's the deal. You do know what you're talking about. At every stage that you are, there is somebody who's not yet to that stage.
Right.
So even if you started your journey yesterday, mm-hmm. you have background and experience in what you're seeing and the way that you're interpreting and understanding the information you're learning. And by sharing your interpretations, you help others on that same journey.
For sure. Because
there's always somebody, when you first start out, there's always somebody a day behind you. Mm-hmm. And then when you move out past that starting, you are in possibly parallel lines to other people where they have not necessarily had the same exact experience, background, et cetera. And mm-hmm. so your interpretations and the way that you make that content relevant and the way that you then learn things or find things or discover things is going to be different than the other person.
Sure.
So you do have something to share, and it's hard to express that to people. And people are so afraid
right.
of what other people might think.
Right.
And I'm going to tell you something about the D4 community. We want you to share because mm-hmm. none of us can do any of this on our own.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who are the fathers of the field, the Brian Carriers, the Warren Cruises, the Eugene Spaffords, the Owen Caseys, who were putting out content and doing things that everybody else has built on. But mm-hmm. since that time, we're all building on each other and together. So.
Right.
Build on somebody else's work or share what you're doing so other people can build on yours. As long as you have things peer reviewed, it's fine. Peer review. Talk to
right.
somebody else at your level. I mean, I've never worked in a lab where we didn't peer review our reports
mm-hmm.
By other people. I would hope to never work in a lab where we don't peer review each other's work.
Sure.
Peer review is critical, not only to the academic process, but to things that are going to court, which by definition, forensic content has the possibility of going to
right.
court. Peer review, peer review, peer review. Do that also with what you're sharing. Peer
right.
review is excellent, and that gives you the confidence. And put it out there. You have something to share, put it out there. And it's hard because you do need that fundamentals before you can share. And so you do need to get those fundamentals. And then you need to really have that integrity of having done the work,
mm-hmm.
right? So you've got training and then you've got work and then you're ready to share, but you need to do it. Like as soon as it's ready, just get over it.
Right.
Just do it. There
right.
are people who have limitations because of where they work, especially when we're talking about digital forensics,
mm-hmm.
law enforcement, government, et cetera. I'm not saying you have to share publicly.
Right.
I'm not sharing you have to share with reference to where you work and who your employer is.
Mm-hmm.
You may be able to share anonymously. You may be able to share without attribution to your employer, but still stating your name.
Mm-hmm.
Or you may be able to share just within your community. I work jobs where I could not be public whatsoever.
Right.
And I shared within my organization and then made sure that content got shared with other government organizations. And that is critical. So don't be afraid to do it. And that's a really hard thing to say because I know it's the hardest thing to get over.
Right.
And we all have demons and imposter syndrome is real.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what we need to do is we all need to name our demon and tell it to be quiet.
I like it. So that's such great perspective, and you're right, the D4 community and lots of other communities, InfoSec, are just really great and really welcoming. Did you naturally gravitate towards sharing and being a part of these communities? And you've been published a bunch of times and you've done a lot of speaking and you're on summit committees for SANS and you know, you've done so many things. Was that natural for you or was it kind of an area of growth?
No, it's an area of growth. And I'm going to tell you something. As somebody who gives talks all the time, right? I spoke at NCCC yesterday, speaking at the D4 Summit tomorrow. I'm on the advisory and on the organizing committee for DFRWS next week.
Mm-hmm.
I get butterflies every single mm-hmm. time. My hands get sweaty the whole night, right? There are things I haven't done yet that I struggle with and that I intentionally try to put myself out there. But when
mm-hmm.
you finish it, the feeling when you've done that work. So here's the deal. You do all this work and all this research and figure out this new stuff, right? What is it if you don't share it? What good does it do anyone else or the community if you don't share it?
Right.
If you share it, you help another case get solved quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't natural, but I used to work a case at a time. And that's the way most forensics examiners work. And you have impact on that case. And that can be the most important case in the world, or it can be a very, very small case within your organization that nobody knows about. No matter what, you have an impact on your case. What if you can take that impact you had on your case from the knowledge and insights and work you did on that case and make it apply to hundreds of thousands of cases all over the world?
Right.
You can multiply your impact. That's why you share. You help other people get to that answer quicker so that they can solve the next problem. And then they can share what they found in that problem that helps you get to your answer quicker. And if we don't do that, we'll never, ever, ever be able to keep up.
Right.
Thousands, hundreds of thousands of applications are out there. The tools support hundreds. The number of differences between versions of Windows and versions of Mac right. and versions of applications and versions, we can never, ever know it all. There will never be a reference book or material or internet source that has it all. So the only way we can create that body of work is if we do it together and share. It's obviously something I'm a little bit passionate about.
A little bit, yeah.
a little bit. So.
That's good advice, though. So
it's hard.
It is. It's difficult and it gets easier.
It
I think
does.
The first few times you do it, you imagine that there are all of these evil people in the crowd. And, you know, you get over it. They're not there. You find out that most people want you to succeed and want to support you. And every once in a while, you get someone who's a little bit of a jerk, but they're much fewer and farther between than it seems like ahead of time.
So, you know, I've put out a lot of content. And I've done it everything from written content in peer-reviewed journals to blog posts to speaking. And you're always worried about that naysayer. You know what? That's they do exist, but it is such a small quantity.
Sure.
It is such a small percentage of the humans that you are going to reach. And what they say doesn't matter. Now, one of the other things that you can do is get a good network of people behind you. Talk and meet other people in your field. Talk to those people whose work you admire. Talk to your peers.
Right.
Get them to see what you're doing. Get their buy-in. It will help your confidence. And guess what? If you have a strong enough network, they're going to help promote your work. And that's going to elevate it. And even more importantly, if you share your work, like Jason, you know what to talk to me about today because you've seen things that I've put out there. If you share your work, when you go in for that interview on the next job, they're not going to ask you about things you don't know. They're going to ask you about your own work.
Right. That's true.
You're going to have that resume built. People are going to know who you are. People are going to be able to check you out beforehand. And I will tell you, people who share get hired more. They get the jobs they want, especially if you're in a SOC today. And your goal is to get into DFIR, which that sometimes happens. There's sometimes people who are working in security operating centers who that was their foot in the door in InfoSec, but they want to be in digital forensics. Do research and put it out there. That is the best way,
right,
in my opinion. Share with the community. It helps the community, but it also helps you.
That's great advice. You're amazing. And I think throughout the course of this conversation, you've become my idol. So,
that's so silly.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Jason, for having me. This has been awesome. Thank you for helping me realize some insights that I never thought of.
You're
so awesome. This has been an honor.
Thanks. That was Jessica Hyde. Many thanks to her for joining us, sharing her background, and all of the great advice that she offered here on the show. Thanks to all of you as well for joining us for another episode of Trust Me, I'm Certified. We'll be back in 2 weeks with Jose Barrientos, a super talented pen tester who almost didn't get a start in the industry until he took his fate in his own hands and refused to take no for an answer. So be sure to check that out. Also, don't forget to subscribe to the show at gac.org/podcast and wherever else you listen to get updates about new episodes as they're released. Thanks again, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.